everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for joining me today for another opportunity to get empowered with truthful information so you can really make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. And if you haven't been listening before, I invite you to go to my website, which is What Women Must Know, and also my Facebook page, which is the same name, What Women Must Know. And I post lots of information. If you opt into my website or like me over at my Facebook page, you'll also get the archive shows, so we don't want you to miss any episodes of this program because we have such fantastic guests with important information. So that's how you can be sure to get all of the archives from the radio shows. And let me just have a few announcements here. Many of you know that I have gone to an amazing place in Costa Rica called the Rhythmia Life Advancement Center, and I took a great group of people there in February. It was life-changing, and I will be going back again this August, August 20th, 27th, right at the time of that solar eclipse, so it'll be really powerful. And this is a one-week experience that provides many opportunities to heal and transform yourself. It's a spa environment in a beautiful place in the state of Costa Rica that's considered the blue zone, where they have the greatest longevity in the cultures around the world. Blue zones are places that people live the longest and healthiest. So we're going to an amazing place, and we also will be doing some healing work with shaman, traditionally trained shaman. So it's a most unique experience, physically healing, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually transforming. So come and check it out. You can contact me directly or go to the website rhythmia.com/Selman event. So I'll be doing my rejuvenation code workshop as part of the bigger program that they're offering. And one other announcement I have, I will be hosting a webinar all about the amazing power of ozone therapy. And ozone therapy is a very powerful modality that has personally saved my mother's leg from amputation. So we're going to be talking all about the benefits of this healing modality for wound healing, for leaky gut, for chronic illnesses, for any kind of skin conditions. List goes on and on, and it's also phenomenal for rejuvenation. So if you want to learn more about my webinar with the good friend of mine who designed the personal ozone generator that I brought back from Australia on my last trip and found it was destined to help my 94-year-old mother recover from some serious issues, then save the date for July 19th. And to learn more, go to trulyheal.com/Selman. And you can also go to my website, What Women Must Know, and opt in there because I'll be sending out an e-blast with all this information. So lots of interesting things going on in my world, and I invite you to come and share it with me. Okay, so today I'm going to be sharing with you tremendously inspiring woman, I have to say, and we're talking about a very profound topic that I happen to be passionate about. We're looking at the most powerful way to help us reduce estrogen excess in our body, how to help prevent breast cancer, prostate cancer, diabetes, support healing of asthma, reduce the risk of autism, help kids with autism improve. I mean, this is a huge topic. And my guest today is Christine Houghton, who is calling us from Brisbane, Australia. And I just want to share a little bit about Christine. So following 30 years in private practice as a nutritional biochemist, Christine is currently engaged in doctoral research at the University of Queensland, investigating bioactive nutrigenomic phytochemicals with significant clinical potential. She is an accomplished writer and an engaging speaker whose evidence-supported presentations may challenge accepted but often outdated paradigms. Christine's forte lies in taking complex biochemical concepts and translating their essence into concepts relevant to the needs of practicing clinicians. She is a regular presenter at medical and nutrition conferences where her knowledge of and enthusiasm for the roles of nutritional medicine and nutrigenomics in human health are very evident. She is the author of Switched On, Harnessing the Power of Nutrigenomics to Optimize Health, and her peer-reviewed publications include the special article published in 2013 in Nutrition Reviews, Sulforaphane, Translational Medicine from Lab Bench to Clinic. So if you're curious about what this is all about, hang in there because we have a fantastic show that really will help to change and improve your health and the health of your family. So, Christine, welcome, and I'm so glad you're calling us all the way from Australia to have this conversation today.
Thank you, Cheryl. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, it's great to have you. You know, it's been a while, but you have been on the show before, and I love having you on my show because you truly do inspire me, Christine. I have learned so much from you, and what we're going to be talking about is near and dear to me because I have been using the nutritional formulas based on the sulforaphane research you've been doing. I have my family on it. I believe it's made such a big difference for me, and I have many of my patients using the sulforaphane products. So I just want you to know I'm passionate about this as well as I know you are, and today we'll help people to understand this huge role of this molecule that we're going to be talking about called sulforaphane. So let's start. Let's just dive in, and maybe we can just define what this molecule is because we're going to be doing lots of talking about sulforaphane.
Well, where do I start? It's such a huge topic. There's now about 1,500 published papers on sulforaphane and quite a lot of clinical trials, about 40 clinical trials as well. So it's an interesting little molecule. It's only very tiny, but it can slip through the membranes of human cells very quickly, so lots of it gets absorbed. But the question is, where does it come from? And it actually comes out of broccoli vegetable, but in much, much greater quantities out of the broccoli sprout. And what's interesting about this is there is no sulforaphane in any of these plants. It only gets made once you eat the food or swallow the capsule. So why does this happen? Well, the plant cell, the broccoli cell or the broccoli sprout cell, contains little compartments, and there's one compound called glucuronin in one compartment of the cell and another compound called myrosinase enzyme in another compartment. So they don't get together while they're in the plant. When you bite or chew or cut the vegetable, you now allow those two compounds to come into contact, and that's the contact that makes the sulforaphane. So the myrosinase enzyme basically attacks the glucuronin and converts to the sulforaphane when you swallow it. So for that reason, there is no sulforaphane in any product or in any food. You make it when you eat it.
And that's so important that people need to understand that we need to either eat the food. It's not either. It's an either or either and, I should say. We need to be eating the foods that help produce this molecule that has to go through the gut and has to be metabolized efficiently to turn the raw material, so to speak, into this powerful molecule, which we will explain why it's so important you want to have this molecule available. And there are also specific supplements that have been demonstrated to ensure the release of sulforaphanes when it's ingested. So we'll talk more about that and what to look for products that work. So I know that some of the primary research, I believe, was done out of Johns Hopkins University for a while.
Yes,
aren't they?
It was.
One of the leaders in this research?
Yeah. Back in the early 90s, Cheryl, there was a group at Johns Hopkins University that discovered that the broccoli sprout is about 50 to 100 times more concentrated in these bioactive compounds than the vegetable. And, I mean, everyone knows broccoli is good for them, but it's not one of the most popular vegetables. And so lots of people are not getting the benefit of it. And the other problem you have is when you cook the vegetable, you kill that myrosinase enzyme. So you really limit the ability to produce sulforaphane from cooked broccoli vegetable.
I'm just going to say, let me jump in. So you have to take the chance of getting sulforaphanes from food would have to then come from raw cruciferous vegetables or raw broccoli?
Yes, preferably raw. But again, that's not something that a lot of people will consume.
Right.
But when you cook it, it's not as if you get no benefit. You will get some benefit because the microflora in the gut, those little bacteria that populate our intestines, have some ability to convert the precursor glucuronin into sulforaphane, but it's only about 8% of what you would get if you didn't kill the enzyme in the first place. So it's quite limited. And so, yes, eating raw vegetable, what I often say to people is, if you want to eat raw broccoli and you don't want to chew up the whole tree, just crumble the broccoli florets over your salad and it kind of just disappears in amongst everything else. Or alternatively, eat broccoli sprouts, or if you don't want to do either of those things, that's where you can take advantage of a high-potency broccoli sprout supplement.
So let's talk about why sulforaphanes play such an important role in all these aspects of health and why you're so committed to helping to bring some exceptional products into
yes.
the marketplace.
Well, it was about 2004 that I discovered this whole concept of the broccoli sprouts. And I was just doing some research on a completely unrelated topic. I was actually looking at melons and the phytochemical properties of melons. And I came across this study on the broccoli sprouts that had come out of Johns Hopkins University. And what I read there was quite amazing. I'd not seen this concept before. They were talking about virtually a switch inside the cells that turns on the protective genes in our cells. And they discovered that this sulforaphane compound from the broccoli sprouts was a very powerful activator of this switch. Now, the switch is actually a chemical compound called NRF2, and it's what's responsible for turning on what's now known to be about 2,000 different protective genes. We also have other aspects of sulforaphane that turn down inflammatory genes. So this was quite a revelation. We'd not seen this before. And their research uncovered the fact that a lot of the protective compounds that were switched on by sulforaphane were the cell's own antioxidant enzymes and the cell's detoxification enzymes and then many other essential components of normal cell function. So we'd thought for 60-odd years or so that, you know, if you wanted to get antioxidants into your system, you should take vitamin C and E and beta-carotene and so on. And as the years have advanced, it turns out that that's not what human cells want. What they want to do is make their own enzymes because their own enzymes are literally millions of times more capable of dealing with free radicals than any of the antioxidant vitamins. So that was a huge revelation to me, and that's what got me started on doing more and more research. Now, when I started looking at the research back in 2004, I think there were only about 700 or 800 papers published. Now we've got double that, 1,500 or so papers. So it's an area which is very exciting to a lot of scientists. And it's an area that's really changed the way we think about human health and how we should be looking after human cells. So that's what gets me up in the morning. It's I know it sounds a bit nerdy, but really exciting because just this last month, June, there were two papers published using sulforaphane. One of them was looking at sulforaphane in type 2 diabetes and trying to uncover the mechanism by which sulforaphane protects human cells against diabetes. So this was a clinical trial, and it was found that one of the things that sulforaphane does is it stops the liver overproducing glucose. It's a process called gluconeogenesis, and sulforaphane stops that happening. So that's valuable for a diabetic patient. But we also know that sulforaphane does other things as well to protect against diabetes. So that was an excellent paper, and excellent in the sense that the doses that they use are doses which are manageable on a practical day-to-day basis. Sometimes with clinical trials, you find that the doses they use in their studies are so high that it's not really practical for someone to do on over the long term. And there've been a couple of studies done on asthma and emphysema using broccoli sprouts, but they were using a broccoli sprout homogenate, which really means you put a large quantity of broccoli sprouts in the blender, put quite a lot of water in there and whiz it up and drink it. Now, I don't think that's something that the average person would want to do every single day. The study had an effective outcome, but it's not really a practical solution. So part of what I wanted to do with my research is to be able to produce such a concentrated source of sulforaphane that with, you know, a couple of capsules or a couple of doses of powder a day, you can achieve what they achieved in these clinical trials. So that's part of where my research is going, in translating that science into something that's useful on a day-to-day basis for the clinician or just for the average person who wants to do something to benefit their health.
Yes, there's so much to talk about when we look at the benefits from taking in sulforaphane. I want you to go back to what you said earlier on, where it was found that sulforaphanes can turn on this pathway that initiates over 2,000 beneficial genes. Can you just elaborate a little bit? Because that's really profound, and I want people to really understand the significance of this pathway when they take in sulforaphane through their diet or through supplementation. I personally think supplementation is required. I just don't think we'll get enough from our diet personally.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree. But I think the more plant food we eat, the greater the potential we have to give ourselves what they need. And the reality is most of us don't eat enough plants. And even though this switch called NRF2 is the key to improving cell function, sulforaphane is without a doubt the most powerful activator of those switches. All plant foods will to some extent activate NRF2. So the more plants you eat, the greater the ability to activate that switch. But let me just try and paint a word picture of what's really happening here. So just imagine you've taken a source of sulforaphane, whether it's the food, the broccoli sprouts, or a capsule or a powder. So you've consumed that. It's in your digestive tract. So it's taken about half an hour to start producing significant quantities of sulforaphane. That now gets absorbed out of your digestive tract into the bloodstream. It's then travelling through the blood and it's going into, let's say, some cells in your liver. So it now crosses into the liver. Now, the real advantage of this tiny little molecule is it glides easily through membranes, and about 80% of what you consume actually ends up in your cells. Now, that's quite remarkable because for a lot of other plant foods, less than 10% and usually around 1% is all that gets into your cells. So that's one of the things that makes this different. So we've got 80% of our sulforaphane now in our cells, and those cells are just like a little round sack. There's a nucleus in the middle, and that's where all the DNA resides, and it's protected in this little sack within the middle. So what we want to do is we want to activate that DNA so that it starts to feed out the enzymes and other compounds that are going to protect your cells. So once the sulforaphane gets into the cell, it's now detected in there by another molecule. And then what happens is the NRF2, this little switch, breaks off and it basically swims its way through the cell, crosses into the nucleus, and then lines itself up along certain genes. So all these 2,000 genes that are protective, there's like a little docking station on each one of these genes. So the NRF2 goes in, finds the docking station, locks itself in, and that is like the switch that activates the production then of a whole lot of enzymes that are being produced according to the formula that that DNA has coded for. So let's suppose now we're producing some detoxification enzymes because the liver is the major seat of detoxification. So then those enzymes then travel out around the cells, they do what they need to do, they break down waste materials, and then there are other genes which code for pumps in the cells. So once the liver has broken down this waste material, it needs to pump it out of the cell. So other genes now activate the pumps, so that pumps it out of the cell back into the bloodstream where it can be eliminated. So it's a very active process. It's very complicated. It's very complicated for scientists as well to understand. And we probably don't understand, well, we certainly don't understand all of the aspects of it. But it's absolutely fascinating because the cell has all these mechanisms built in. What we're trying to do with nutrigenomics is use food compounds that activate genes. So Nutra as in food, genomics as in gene. We're using food compounds to switch on genes. So that's essentially what sulforaphane does, and nutrigenomics is the branch of nutrition science that explains how that process works.
Yes, it's really fascinating because we are using this molecule to kind of awaken these genes to really do their job most efficiently to protect us, to help us with detoxification, help us dealing with inflammation, help us deal with free radicals. I mean, there are some huge jobs that are initiated by taking this molecule, which is why it's so important.
Yeah, and it's the core processes of the cell that are most activated, and that's the amazing thing about it. I like to use the analogy of a Christmas tree. So let's suppose your Christmas tree has got 2,000 light bulbs on it. You've got one switch over on the wall. When you turn on that switch, you turn on the whole 2,000 light bulbs at once. And that's a bit what the story is like with sulforaphane. The NRF2 is the switch. And when you put that switch on, you're switching on those 2,000 or so genes all at the same time, which is quite remarkable. And it's almost as if the cell says, look, this is the toolbox here for protecting us. Let's get all the tools out of the box and let's get them to work at the same time. So we're really just harnessing what Mother Nature put there. That is really all we're doing. And we're choosing certain compounds specifically out of particular foods that we have been able to show are the most powerful. And that's what the Johns Hopkins research found back in 1992, and it's been scientists since then who've built on that story and have done more and more studies. Some of the studies are just test tube studies where we put sulforaphane into a dish of cells to see what happens, but more and more the studies are clinical trials, and that's really the important part because there's no point in finding amazing things out in a dish of cells on your lab bench if the same thing doesn't happen when an individual takes that food into their bodies. So the 40 or so clinical trials that we now have are really confirming what the original science was discovering just out of the lab bench.
So let's explore some of the very practical benefits when you take in sulforaphane through your diet, through supplementation. And one of the areas that I have great interest in is the role of proper detoxification of the estrogen chemicals and hormones that circulate through our body. Can you talk a little bit about
that?
Yeah,
I'd love to talk about that, Cheryl, because I think there's so much misinformation on that subject, and a lot of the information that I was exposed to as a clinician is really only telling part of the story. So it's very complex. Let me see if I can make it simple. So we have a detoxification process in all of our cells that's made up of what we call a phase one and a phase two. And so when a toxic compound, and we'll call it an estrogen because we know that estrogen in excess is toxic, just as environmental pollutants are toxic. And so the same pathway is used. If you're cooking a barbecue and your steak becomes blackened, those toxic compounds are broken down in exactly the same way that the estrogens are broken down. So we need to sort of put that in perspective. This is how cells break down waste products that are potentially toxic. And what do I mean by toxic? What I mean is that if our DNA is damaged in any way by a compound in the cell or any other effect, it could be radiation, if we damage our DNA permanently, we are likely to produce cancer cells. And that's ultimately what we're trying to stop from happening when we're looking at detoxification. Our primary goal is to protect our DNA against damage, because once it gets damaged and it starts producing one cancer cell, those cells keep on multiplying because the DNA code now tells the cell to make these damaged cancer-type cells. So that's our ultimate goal. So when the estrogen or environmental compound gets into the cell, it gets acted on by the phase one enzymes. And these phase one enzymes will activate that molecule so that it is presented to the phase two stage in a way that it can handle. But unfortunately, if your phase one activity goes too quickly for phase two, you produce a lot of intermediate compounds which are often more toxic than the thing you started with. And that's what can happen with estrogens. So the estrogens, when they're acted on by phase one, can produce these intermediate compounds called quinones and other molecules in the quinone family. So if you can't break those quinones down fast enough, that will then lead to the damage of the DNA. So the cell has many steps in process to break that intermediate compound down. The first thing that it does is it uses an enzyme called COMT, and anybody who has had a gene profile done will have probably had their COMT gene looked at. So that's COMT, which is an abbreviation for a longer word. So what we do then is we will methylate part of that estrogen that's been, that estrogen breakdown product, and that gets it out of the way. But unfortunately, COMT can't take up all of the estrogen metabolite. So those metabolites go along a few steps further. And a couple of enzymes, one of them's called glutathione S-transferase, will break down part of the rest of that estrogen metabolite. And if still you haven't broken it all down, you're getting closer to damaging your DNA, there's a very powerful enzyme called quinone reductase, and it basically rescues that estrogen quinone from touching the DNA. It recycles it back to the beginning. It goes back to COMT. It goes back to glutathione S-transferase, and it keeps recycling until all of the estrogen is broken down and protected the DNA. So if any of your listeners have had this gene profile done, they've probably looked at their cytochrome P450 enzyme, so that's CYP1B1 and 1A1. So they're the phase one enzymes, and they've probably got their COMP gene, COMT, the glutathione S-transferase is GST, and their quinone reductase is NQO1, and probably superoxide dismutase, which is SOD. So all of those enzymes play their role, and your genetic profile will tell you whether they're functioning as the normal variant or whether you have an abnormal variant. So the ideal scenario is if you have a normal or slow phase one and you have a fast phase two. So that means when phase one produces these toxic intermediate compounds, they're not presented to the phase two too quickly for phase two to handle, because if phase two can't handle them, some of that estrogen metabolite will get through to the DNA and damage it. So what's interesting with sulforaphane is that it doesn't do much with phase one at all. It kind of ignores it. But what it really does is upregulates or increases the activity of phase two. So therefore, even if you have a naturally faster phase one, if your phase two is going fast as well, you can get rid of those compounds and dispose of them safely. So I think in the past, a lot of the story has focused on looking at compounds like indole-3-carbinol and diindolylmethane, both of which are found, or the indole-3-carbinol is found in mature broccoli vegetable, the DIM gets made in your stomach. But those compounds are only addressing the estrogen receptor and phase one, and they do practically nothing in phase two. It's sulforaphane that really upregulates your phase two, and that's why I think we're having the benefits with sulforaphane that we were never able to get with those other broccoli-based compounds.
And I think it's really important to help people understand the relevance of why you want to have proper detoxification of estrogen compounds to the liver. Why you want the liver to be efficient at taking care of these compounds, because if it doesn't, there are consequences or risk factors to our health. Do you want to just elaborate a little bit more about that? Because that to me is so critical for people to understand.
Yes, because if we don't break down toxins, whether they're estrogen or just environmental or even other toxins that just come from normal day-to-day metabolism, those compounds are very damaging to human cells. They can cause oxidative damage. They can damage enzymes and proteins and membranes, and all parts of the cell can be damaged. It can certainly block little parts of our cell called mitochondria. They're the energy powerhouses of the cell. And if you damage the mitochondria, you're not able to produce enough energy. And it's energy not only that makes you feel bright and alive, but the energy that drives most other chemical reactions in the body. So having a toxic burden in your system, or just a sluggish detoxification process, really makes everything else more sluggish. The other consequence of that is that these oxidized or damaging molecules that are in the system then tend to promote inflammation. So inflammation is underpinning a whole host of diseases, not just, say, the inflammation in a joint, the aches and pains of, say, an inflamed knee or ankle, but also inflammation throughout the body. So there's a lot of research now done on neuroinflammation, which means inflammation in the brain and the rest of the nervous system. And there are a whole lot of diseases now known to be underpinned by neuroinflammation. So it just really affects every system. We referred to asthma before. Asthma is an inflammation of the airways. So if the airways become inflamed and swollen, you can't breathe properly. So that inflammation is a process which damages any part of the body, not just the obvious things like that produce the aches and pains. And so what we're trying to do is to try and travel upstream, we call it, and try and get to the primary cause of a problem. So if the primary cause of a problem is that the cells can't protect themselves against free radical activity or the effect of toxins, or they're unable to detoxify adequately, then we get these downstream effects that just spread out and can affect all sorts of processes. So from my standpoint, looking at cell function, I feel what we need to do is focus on enhancing the function of every cell in the body Mother Nature will do a lot of the rest of it. If we deal with those upstream processes, then a lot of other things will just fix themselves, whether or not we do anything specific for it.
Well, I just want to say that I was introduced to these issues through learning about nutrigenomic testing, and it's something that I've been doing for, I don't guess, about 5 years now, and that's how we first connected, was through the nutrigenomic testing and learning about what compounds can have the greatest effect talking to our genes. And I've done hundreds and hundreds of tests at this point in time, which to me is one of the most profound tests anyone can do, and it certainly, I believe, is a test that's saved my life because of what I learned and the changes that I made in my diet. Even though I thought I was doing a healthy diet, I wasn't targeting my needs specifically, which is what the nutrigenomic testing does. And what I learned from the instruction that I got in the, you know, this classes around how to do nutrigenomic testing and everything I've researched since, is that the sulforaphane molecule is one of the most powerful molecules we could be taking in that will address the key issues that are the drivers of chronic illness. So that includes inflammation, which you just talked about. It talks about it's relevant to detoxification pathways, which you mentioned. It's also profound in helping to what we call upregulate your primary antioxidants, and you mentioned that earlier in our conversation, the most powerful antioxidants that our own cells make, and some other functions. So and I want to say that in looking at the test of hundreds of people of all ages, I have found that the vast, vast majority of people have inherited, compromised or inefficient, or I like to say some software glitches that makes them less than optimal in their body's capacity to manage inflammation, oxidative stress, detoxification, and that's where we need to get the right support. So,
I couldn't have said that better, Cheryl. That's exactly what it's about, and it gives us the opportunity now to personalize medicine. I mean, in the early days of practice, we would just simply talk about the ideal diet. There would be public health authorities would say you must eat this and you must eat that and so many serves of fruit and vegetables a day. And in principle, that's fine, because that is the only way you can deal with large populations. But at an individual level, if you have this test done, you only have to do it once, because it's just showing you the genes that you're born with. But in particular, it's showing the weaknesses that you have in your cells. And that gives you the opportunity then to target exactly what's best for you. So that is really the beauty of nutrigenetic testing followed by nutrigenomic prescriptions. And it's completely changed the way I see clinical care and preventive medicine.
Yes, you know, it's been an eye-opener for me, and using things like sulforaphane products as foundational products. I tell people there are certain products that I consider to be absolutely essential for the long term. You know, these are the critical nutrients that are going to be talking to your genes to optimize their function. You may want to bring in other supplementation down the track, you know, things, you know, just to help us balance the issues that may arise. But there are certain foundational supplements, and sulforaphanes are one of them, that have to be part of our, you know, most basic nutritional protocol to help us to do these things. I mean, we live in a world that's incredibly toxic. We're ingesting toxins all the time. We're under incredible stress. We're being affected by, you know, electro pollution, which has an impact on inflammation, oxidative stress. I mean, we need support. And most people just inherited genes that have not been able to keep up with the 21st century condition.
Exactly. The other thing that's interesting there is that this NRF2 switch in the cell declines in its efficiency as the years go on. So You know, that's just a normal aging process. But what we can do with something like sulforaphane that can activate NRF2 is we can enhance the activity of that NRF2 closer towards the activity that it would have been when you were much younger. I won't say we're going to reverse it because we don't. But there are researchers that talk about NRF2 as part of the longevity process of the cell. So that if you can have ideal NRF2 activity, you will certainly improve cell function, which means cells will live longer. Now, there have been studies in animals which have actually demonstrated that. We haven't demonstrated a longevity effect in humans yet, but you never know. We may at some stage do that. And it makes sense because if you can improve the efficiency of every cell in the body, naturally you're going to ward off the kinds of diseases that tend to cause premature aging. So it's completely logical.
So I want to go into more specific conditions that have really responded well to the sulforaphanes. But before we do that, there's one other function of sulforaphanes that we haven't touched upon, and maybe you can just help me understand some of the research, and that has to do with the vitamin D receptors in our body. We are all aware of the importance of vitamin D, the hormone, but recently the research is looking more at the importance of optimizing our vitamin D receptor sites. Can you share a little bit more about that to help
Yes, that's an interesting one, and I discovered this quite by accident. And what I mean by that is, because it's become sort of more topical in recent years to look at a patient's vitamin D status, and so what's been happening is patients are having their vitamin D blood levels measured, then they're given vitamin D if they're low, and in some cases I would get doctors saying, I'm giving my patient more and more vitamin D and I still can't get their blood levels to come up. And now I'm concerned something odd is happening here and I can't keep increasing their vitamin D. So what's going on? So I got that story from a few people and I didn't know the answer. Then I started to get a different story coming from other doctors. They'd started just incidentally giving these same patients a sulforaphane-containing supplement or yielding supplement, and they found that they didn't need to keep giving the high levels of vitamin D. The blood levels started coming up. So they said, you know, what's going on here? First of all, they can't get their vitamin D levels up. Is the sulforaphane in some way helping this? So I did a little bit of research. There's not a lot of research on it, but there is enough that shows that the vitamin D receptor gene, which we know can have a lot of variations, that is activated by sulforaphane. And so that was the missing piece of the puzzle. So it's all very well to have high levels of vitamin D floating around in your bloodstream, but if it hasn't got a receptor somewhere to hook onto, it doesn't really make a lot of difference. The vitamin D on its own is useless unless it can attach to a receptor, and once it does that, that then sends signals to other parts of the cell. So more and more, and there has not been any further research that I know I've done on this in recent times, but more and more I've discovered by speaking to doctors that this is exactly what happens when the vitamin D receptor in the patient is the abnormal variant and they give sulforaphane. They find the vitamin D status improves and the patient now can take a normal level of vitamin D supplement to have a normal blood level. So that's interesting, and it's something that I would like to do some proper research on at some stage. So all I'm passing on at the moment is anecdotal stories, but from many, many examples of that, and it's enough of the anecdotal stories for me to realise that this is really something significant that we need to look into further.
What's fascinating to me is that this one little molecule can do so many important jobs. I don't know of any other molecule that can be a powerful anti-inflammatory, a powerful antioxidant, a primary antioxidant, help with phase one, phase two, do this this vitamin D receptor gene Do you know of any molecule that is as versatile as this?
Yes and no, and let me explain what I mean. So if we look simply at lab bench studies, if you get a tray of liver cells, for example, you can find compounds like curcumin, resveratrol, the ECGC out of green tea. You'll find those compounds will activate NRF2 and they will do certain things that help to enhance cell function, not as powerfully as sulforaphane, but they do them. The problem in practice is that these compounds are what we call polyphenols, and they're big, bulky molecules, and they can't get into the cells. So where I said before, sulforaphane is a small, narrow molecule that can just glide into the cells, and about 80% of what you consume gets into your cells. Something like curcumin, about 1% gets into your cells. Mm. It's even less with resveratrol. So that's one of the big issues. These big bulky molecules don't get into the cells. What they do in the gut because they can neutralize free radicals in the food. So if you ate that big barbecued steak with all the blackened carcinogens on it, curcumin or green tea at the same time or resveratrol will quench those radicals. But once you get into the cells, there's so little in there, it really doesn't make a difference. You can't eat enough curcumin or green tea or drink enough red wine to get the resveratrol to get into your cells. And that point is often overlooked. And I often read articles from science journalists who I think are really over-sensationalizing. There'll be a scientific study that's being reported that shows something that's, I'm just making this up, 52% of prostate cancer cells destroyed by curcumin. And people run out now and they buy lots of curcumin. But the science journalist doesn't point out that that was done in a tray of cells on a lab bench. When you swallow it, that doesn't happen in your body. And that's the missing link that I think is so much overlooked, and I think people really need to understand. It doesn't matter what you can do in the lab. If you can't replicate those findings in a human clinical trial, what have you done that's useful? Nothing.
Right. So having said all this, let's talk about some of the practical application with various health challenges that have been demonstrated. And, why don't you share a bit, of the conditions, the various issues that have benefited from the use of sulforaphanes?
Mm-hmm. So one of the areas now, which I think there are now three clinical trials on this, and they all show similar benefit, and it's in relation to the Helicobacter pylori organism. So this is a little bacteria that can live in the wall of the stomach, is known to produce reflux-type conditions, can produce ulcers, and can ultimately cause cancer of the stomach. So it's a nasty little bug. It burrows into the wall of the stomach, and it's very hard to deal with. Medically, there's a very potent therapy, which we call triple therapy, which is basically three very powerful antimicrobial or antibiotic compounds that destroy that organism or partially destroy it. In the same time, you're killing all the microflora in the gut and you're having all sorts of other problems as a consequence. So that's the standard therapy for Helicobacter infections. Interestingly, manageable doses of sulforaphane will do exactly that, and the three studies that have now been done have been done over an 8-week period to show that you can get the same measure of control of the Helicobacter organism using sulforaphane as you get with the triple therapy. So that's pretty remarkable because you're not getting all the nasty adverse effects at the same time. Now, there is a rider on this, and the rider is that when the therapy was stopped, after a period of time, that Helicobacter organism starts to grow and multiply again. But it also does that on the triple therapy. So we didn't really completely destroy it. What we don't know, though, is if we kept the patient on the sulforaphane-yielding supplement for more than 8 weeks, if we left them on it for 6 months or 12 months or indefinitely, would we get total eradication of that infection. We don't know. But the good news is there's no difficulty in continuing to take a sulforaphane-yielding supplement over the longer term. So that's a very beneficial finding, as you know, one of the clinical trials that's been replicated on two other occasions.
Right. So you don't. So it has the same benefits as this antibiotic option, of course, without the side effects, but with all the other health benefits of ingesting sulforaphane.
Well, that's right. Yes. You're getting a whole lot of other things happening as well. Something that sometimes happens, which I should mention when you're dealing with intestinal problems, is a lot of people suffer from inflammatory bowel disease of some kind. Sometimes it's just as simple as, you know, rumbly tummy or occasional bouts of diarrhea and alternating constipation and so on. So that's fairly common within the community. It's thought in some cases to be caused by what we call gut dysbiosis, which means the wrong balance of bacteria living in the digestive tract. So it's also known that if you try to kill those abnormal bacteria too quickly, you get this die-off effect, and people can feel really quite off colour. Not only terrible bouts of diarrhea and bloating and discomfort, but also headachy and just seedy. So that die-off reaction will be stopped if you slow the treatment down. So it's just killing the bugs too quickly. Now, in some patients, they can get that sort of die-off reaction if they take too much sulforaphane too quickly. And so I've occasionally had people talk to me and say, look, I took that broccoli sprout supplement. I can't take it. It makes me sick. My stomach's terrible. I feel worse. It disagrees with me. And I say, you've really just identified the nature of your problem. I suspect you've got gut dysbiosis. All we're doing is killing these bugs off too quickly. Let's just slow it right down. Mm-hmm. And if they're taking it as a powder, I say, just get your sharpest paring knife from the kitchen and just the very sharp tip of that blade, put that much powder on the end of it, put that in some water and take that twice a day. Gradually increase that over 2 weeks until you're up to, say, 2 capsules a day. You'll find your symptoms will have gone and you probably will feel a lot better in the digestive system than you've felt for a very long time. And I see that again and again. But it's important to note that people realise if they seem to get worse before they get better, it's a good sign. It's not a bad sign.
And that kind of segues nicely into the role of sulforaphanes with autism.
Yes, because so often these poor little kids or even grown-up autistic patients have enormous amounts of digestive problem, and it's well known. And so there was a clinical trial done at the end of 2014 on autistic adults. And what they showed is that they gave these patients just a sulforaphane-yielding supplement. They didn't change their diet. They didn't do any of the other things that clinicians in nutritional medicine would normally do when they're dealing with a patient with autism. They simply gave them the supplement, and they gave it to them for 18 weeks. So they were looking at various measures of the sorts of symptoms that are common in autism, things like social responsiveness, verbal communication, behaviour. And they found in all three of those conditions, they got a significant drop in those symptoms when the patient was taking the sulforaphane. Now, they didn't comment on the digestive symptoms. They weren't actually looking at that in that study. But clinicians everywhere will tell you that digestive symptoms are a common presentation in autism. The other thing that's interesting with that study is that they compared it with placebo, so the placebo patients didn't get any benefit to any extent, but when they stopped the supplement at 18 weeks, they continued to assess them for a further 4 weeks, and they did find that the symptoms started to return. So again, we don't know whether had they kept that trial going for longer, whether they would have got a more permanent benefit. But you say, how does sulforaphane that's working in the gut have anything to do with what's going on in the brain? And of course, it's all tied to the neuroinflammation, which I mentioned earlier. Sulforaphane is very, very potently anti-inflammatory in the brain. It's also capable of very easily crossing the blood-brain barrier, which is often a barrier that prevents other compounds from getting through. And so at the same time as they're dealing with the gut symptoms, they're able to deal with neuroinflammation. So quite remarkable. In Australia, there are a lot of doctors who specialise in treating neuroinflammatory conditions, which includes autism. And we get feedback on some quite remarkable results of changes that quite dramatically occur in these patients. It seems, however, that there is permanent damage of some kind. They don't seem to be able to be cured in the strict sense of the word, but I think the families of these children, and it's usually children we're dealing with here, are just so grateful that they get any measure of beneficial change of any significance in their child, where they can start to communicate again, they get some verbal skills. Often these children have no language at all. And you can imagine what it's like for a family when the parents start to see their child attempting to communicate and starting to develop some language skills. It just changes not just the child's life, but the entire family.
Christine, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and your research with us today. I know that a lot of people will now be looking into sulforaphanes and incorporating them into their diet, whether they take it as those wonderful cruciferous vegetables or take a powerful, proven supplement like what you've been researching and dealing with. So, again, thank you for your time and sharing so much of your great wisdom and information with us today.
Always a pleasure, Cheryl. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And to all of you listening, thank you again for joining me for another opportunity to really get empowered with the knowledge that makes such a difference in our lives. And until next time, always remember to honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.